All right, good morning. Please be seated. This case is Kerry Humphries and Lorenzo Roca versus 8th Judicial District, case number 61690. Counsel, ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right, go ahead, Mr. Sherman.
Hey, please, the court, counsel. My name is Josh Tomczyk, and along with Mr. Craig Drummond, we have the privilege of representing the petitioners Kerry Humphries and Lorenzo Roca in this matter. As we've previously indicated to the court, Mr. Drummond will be doing the rebuttal in this case as to the real party in interest, New York, New York's argument. I would ask that we be allowed to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, and for simplicity's sake, we'll be referring to the real party in interest as New York, New York. In order for this court to fully address the issues before the court today, I believe it is important that the court hear a very brief factual recitation of the case as it relates to why we are here and how we got to this point. On April 10th of 2010, the petitioners, Kerry Humphries and her fiancé, Lorenzo Roca, were visitors in Las Vegas from the state of California. They were at the New York, New York Hotel and Casino. While walking across the casino floor, Ms. Humphries stopped to ask another female patron where she had got her outfit and to compliment her on it. At approximately that same time, an individual by the name of Eric Farrell approached her and began to make comments to her, inappropriate comments of a sexual nature. At that time, she rebuffed him and he reacted. He punched her repeatedly. Eric Farrell turned his attention physically towards her fiancé, Lorenzo, who, in the absence of security, had attempted to come to her aid. This event was not brief. It was an enduring attack. And as a result of that attack, there are enduring, painful, physical consequences because of the injuries sustained by the petitioners in this case. The reason those facts are important for this court's determination is not because those facts are the basis of the lawsuit that ultimately gives rise to why we're here today. In fact, the actions of Eric Farrell, as he's been termed in the pleadings in this case, the intentional tortfeasor, are not the basis of this lawsuit at all. Rather, as this court should be aware, it is the inaction of the New York, New York, the powers that be at the premises who own a duty to make it safe for the patrons there, like the petitioners, that were before this court. What this case is, and always has been from its inception, is a case of negligent security based on New York, New York's failure to abide by their legal duty to their patrons. What this case is not, and it should be clear from the record, is a grasping at straws attempt to reach into the coffers of a deep-pocketed defendant. Before your honors, you have the record, and in the record, it should be clear in the New York, New York Council's own appendix to their pleadings in this case, they attach documents. At date stamp 11 of their appendix, they attached a document that illustrates that petitioner Kerry Humphries and Lorenzo Roca, 33 hours after this incident, were in meetings with the New York, New York, discussing them with them specifically their concern at the failure of security to respond in a timely manner and protect them. That's what this case has always been about. And throughout the discovery process before we came to this court, it was affirmed that that concern was with reason. On May 8th of 2012, a deposition was taken of an individual by the name of Glenn Murray, who is the person most knowledgeable of security crime and crime prevention, including assaults and batteries, as that perpetrated by Eric Farrell. And in that deposition, he indicated, under oath, that at the time this incident occurred, New York, New York, had but a single security officer who responded to this incident. When that security officer responded, he stood there and watched Ms. Humphries be beaten for a period of 12 to 15 seconds. He indicated that he had no idea how many security personnel would be necessary to keep that premises safe on an 85,000 square foot casino floor, which serves alcohol at all hours of the day. And he indicated that not only, A, was this action foreseeable because there were multiple such similar instances occurring on a weekly basis, approximately every other day. He indicated approximately 2 to 3 per week, fights of a violent nature on the floor of the New York, New York. He indicated that if they had had more security, that this altercation could have been prevented and the extent of the damage done in this altercation would have been prevented. That is the record as it pertains to the negligent actions of New York, New York, which give rise to this negligence lawsuit against New York, New York. And I will reiterate, that's what this case has always been, an allegation of negligent security on behalf of the New York, New York. The question now before the court with that factual background, which was first raised by counsel for New York, New York, is whether the person committing the intentional tort, Mr. Farrell, should be necessarily joined in this case, which is, again, and always has been, again, a negligence action against New York, New York. And this is an important point for the court's consideration. To take such a leap, to ask this court to impose that blanket rule that an intentional tortfeasor must be joined with a negligent tortfeasor in a case such as this, the New York, New York has asked the district court below and is now asking this court to establish a rule that has never been applied.
Well, do you read Kaplan motive like that broadly, or is it confined somewhat?
Not at all. To be clear, neither Mr. Drummond, myself, or the petitioners in this case have any quibble with the ruling in Cafe Moda. I've read Cafe Moda countless times, and to me, it's an analysis of a comparative negligence statute, a trial rule, having to do with a couple of different scenarios, but for purposes of New York, New York's interest in this case, the apportionment of damages in a case where you have a negligent and an intentional tortfeasor. So there's no confusion when a trier of fact listens to a case at trial and makes a determination about which party is at fault to which percent. I would submit to the court that Cafe Moda has nothing to do with the premise for which the New York, New York has raised it in this case.
Because this is not a 41-141 case?
This case is not a 41-141 case because it is not an issue of apportionment of the damages between an intentional tortfeasor and a negligent tortfeasor. It's not. For any damages to be awarded in this case, a jury would first have to make a determination that a negligent act or inact took place. They would have to find negligence. The rule that the New York, New York is asking this court to impose has never been applied in any case in any jurisdiction, state or federal, in the history of American jurisprudence. And in effect, what they're asking this court to do is to ask that rule be put into place not only without a single shred of authority, but to replace the existing rule of law that it is the plaintiff's right to sue whom they choose for which causes of action they choose. I would submit to the court that Cafe Moda simply has no applicability in a case under this set of circumstances. To get Cafe Moda to the Cafe Moda argument before the court in order to attempt to make the rule of law that Rule 19 requires joinder of an intentional tortfeasor under a set of circumstances like this, you have to first apply Rule 19, and Rule 19 has to be relevant and important to the determination. This isn't that case, and the reason I keep hammering the issue of this is solely a negligence case is because Rule 19, subsection A, first of all, only applies in a situation where it's feasible to join the intentional tortfeasor under this set of circumstances. In this case, it was never feasible. The request was never made until after the statute of limitations was run. But secondly, it only applies in a situation where complete relief cannot be accorded among those already parties. The petitioners in this case, in New York, New York, can have complete relief of their claims in this case. New York, New York can say we weren't negligent. The petitioners can allege that they were. The jury can make that determination, and the damages can be awarded if the jury sees fit and finds negligence. While it has been couched in the pleadings that this is an issue of first impression for this court, I would submit to the court that all you need to do to find a determination of this same issue is to look to the annotation of the federal rule. Federal circuits and district courts have made this determination for years and have held that the defendant's right to apportionment of liability pursuant to state law, as was determined in Cafe Moda, does not make the proposed additional party indispensable within the meaning of Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 19. Same rule applies here. There's nothing in Federal Rule 19 or the Cafe Moda decision that makes an intentional tortfeasor a necessary party. I believe that is all the time I have, reserving the rest of time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
I'm going to please the court and counsel.
We're Martin Kravitz again on the same issue. This one's a little bit different.
In that chair over there this time.
Yeah, I had to move sides.
Yeah.
This time because we were in that little court. There is a decision in this case that's rather critical, which became the focus of the last case, which is there's an affirmative defense of comparative negligence. And the reason it was raised is because, unlike the last case where we never had an opportunity even to interview Ms. Moran, she took off from the hotel, told the police, and that's how we found out about it. In this case, we had a report. And it's interesting the way the rendition of the facts came down that we were just told, because I left out a few critical facts. One of which is this fight started because this particular plaintiff was hopefully spit on the attacker. He became enraged, punched her, and we had a security officer within about 100 feet of this incident, but it turned into a three-party brawl. And the policy and the training of the New York is simple. If you are overwhelmed by members, you get help. That's why it took 12 to 15 seconds for them to arrive and rip this individual off. I will also tell you, this is the first incident that I've seen in my career, let alone New York, where a man hit a woman. We have an absolute intentional tort, and Ms. Humphreys herself participated in the criminal proceedings against him. They had a time to sue him. They elected not to sue him. He was never sued by them. So when he tells you that this doesn't implicate 41.141, it does by virtue of the initial pleading saying that she's comparative negligence. And that's how I read your Cafe Moda decision now saying you're entitled to apportionment with the intentional tortfeasor. And the reason we brought these cases, by the way, is because you left us in something of a lurch. We needed to know what is the guidance from this court as to how to proceed when you don't name the intentional tortfeasor and when you name the intentional tortfeasor.
Can you explain something? I hate to throw you off your train of thought, but you said that comparative negligence was pled in this action, but the intentional tortfeasor was not a party to this action at any time?
Never.
And so in your answer, you pled comparative, let me see. Okay, got it.
We triggered the statute, it was there. I literally made a phone call, we had a break to make sure that it was in there, but it definitely was in there.
It wasn't clear going through the record in this whether or not it was pled either.
Yeah, I deliberately made that phone call because I became concerned after Judge Hardesty's comments. I also wanted to address something else, which was in Justice Cherry's comments, he was concerned that, well, you could sue 2 years after the fact. But that forces the defendant to have to try his case twice. And it forces them to expend more money when you can all take care of it in one spot. The issue then becomes, in this case, your focus is a lot different. Your focus is clearly that this issue is out there and the jury has to erase it. Ultimately, I've not raised the Sabre Smith, which is no defense of this case, but we are dealing with how do we proceed now? Do we get to go ahead and bring the third party, are we forced to bring the third party in, or should they have done it? They should have done this in this case. They knew who he was, they knew what the fight circumstances were, and they had the opportunity to do so, and they simply let it go. Now, I will say this. Their constant defense to this is, well, it's too late. When you brought Cafe Moda up, it was already too late under the statute. Well, we didn't have Cafe Moda until the statute had run. We worked quickly. And more importantly, the statute of limitations is one of those affirmative defenses that needs to be raised in the initial pleading. Conceivably, I have seen it, although I don't know whether he'll appear or not, but if it's not raised, it's waived. That one goes away, and then he is a party to the proceeding. The other thing is the idea that the comparative negligence statute itself, requires that this were nothing more than a simple car accident. This is not the only statute that's out there that requires potentially an apportionment of liability among parties. If you look at a circumstance such as a malpractice case, the legislature determined that it was important in malpractice cases if you had more than one culpable doctor to name them. Because if you didn't name them all, you wouldn't hold the primary doctor 100% responsible if he only has a portion of it. In a simple car accident with three parties involved, if you have a plaintiff who has 1% compared to negligent, then the statute triggers to say that you need to bring all the defendants to the table because you could be left without a remedy. If you don't sue them all, you have potential culpability.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Could you read Justice Perigueri's decision in Cafe Motor to say that you could apportion without the intentional tortfeasor being there? To where a jury would come back on a special interrogatory saying, Mandalay Bay or New York, New York is liable for 30% of what they get.
If you give us that instruction under this case law, we'd be thrilled with it. It would be just as good.
You remember what Justice Perigueri wrote?
Well, Justice Perigueri doesn't make that distinction. He didn't go that far, which is why both of these cases are before you. What we saw is that it would be better to have all the parties at the table and then give us some instruction when you have Rule 19 that says we know who this defendant is. Let me distinguish two cases. I guess that's the way to deal with it. Suppose we don't know who the attacker is. That happens occasionally. He gets away with it. How do you bring that person to the table? Under those circumstances, you're definitely going to be left in a situation where you should be allowed to apportion against the doe and do it by special instructions.
Would that require this court to clarify, if not overrule, one brought?
You know, I'm not familiar with one brought. I'm sorry. I think at the very least you need some clarification on Cafe Murder how to proceed with or without an intentional tortfeasor.
If I read one brought correctly, I believe that case holds that it precludes apportionment between parties and non-parties.
So then you have to give us the opportunity then to bring that party in. And the answer would be if they don't assume, you need to let us implicate them. If we know who they are, then
so if you don't know the intentional tortfeasor, you can never apportion?
I would find to be a horrible result, because I don't think that's what the legislature intended.
It's an interesting question you posit. If we were to approach this the way other cases have looked at the Uniform Comparative Fault Act, generally the approach has said that the person who's interested in having the person added is the one who should be bringing them in. Why shouldn't Nevada adopt that approach, as other states have in their interpretation of the Uniform Comparative Fault Act, which would place the responsibility on your client to add them as a party?
I think we could live with it. I really do. If the ruling and the implication of Cafe Murder is that we should implead in as a third party the named defendant, then let us do that. So long as...
Implead under what theory? Talking about contribution?
And indemnity. Both of them are available to, contribution and apportionment.
Mm-hmm.
Give me the opportunity to put before the jury exactly, the wrong contribution comes 2 years after you pay, that's the statute of limitations, but we could do it all in one place. Number two, apportionment would be required in the same verdict. So when the jury sits and says there's X $100,000 of it.
You have the ability to plead for a contribution and apportionment, doesn't that undermine the necessary and indispensable aspect?
I've always looked at it as how do you simply waive an intentional tort that causes the damage? There isn't any damage if Eric Furrow doesn't punch her. There isn't any damage if Miss Moran isn't raped. And all of our liability is built upon that ladder, which is the first act has to occur. The problem with security cases is they're occurring the premises, there's sort of this presumption that somehow you could have stopped it. Well, the defense is it's almost impossible to stop some rapid-fire conduct such as this. 12 to 15 seconds, it's pretty hard for a human being to react, jump in, and deal with it. The first punch in this case broke her jaw. She told me that in her deposition. That's what she
said. Even if you don't have the intentional tortfeasor available, I don't know if you're familiar with the case we kicked out a little bit before Cafe Motive. It was called Smith versus Mahoney's Silver Nugget.
That's my case.
Yes.
It is no case.
And so tell me, why doesn't that offer you some protection in that regard?
In May, Your Honor, but we haven't gotten to that stage yet. And here's what Smith versus Mahoney says. In fact, I've used it many times now for summary judgment. In Smith, you have to show there wasn't evidence of a similar happening as the first prong of your test. And in this case, their argument is going to be whether there are multiple fights. I will be arguing to a district judge within their discretion it's never happened like this, whether it's been man or woman. But the second part of that is that they have basic minimum security. And that's always sort of the more difficult question. What you said, and I find it fascinating, and this is another case that's probably going to need clarification, but what does basic minimum security mean? Some judges are reading it to be basic optimum security. It could have been better security. When you put that, posited that question to some of the district court judges, they go back and give you a little more discovery to find out. Well, we just won one. Where the judge finally concluded that there wasn't, that we had met the basic minimum security standard. We had a full staff, and there was a shooting at a hotel, random. The guy tried to commit suicide by cop, and the end result is, there was no similar happening, and there was plenty of basic minimum security, so we won summary judgment. You have left us with a potential other defense, but that's not what's available right now. But right now is the open-ended question, and the open-ended question is, how do we get apportionment relief, contribution relief in one setting? We'll be happy with a result that says we must implead the third party, so long as I can make those arguments at the time of trial, if we get that far. Because, as I said, we might want to bring up a state of Smith versus Mahoney's. And in that way, we get the relief that we seek, the remedies appropriate, the jury gets to evaluate all culpabilities, the plaintiff, in each of the defendants. Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, Tom, that's all. Do you have any questions for me?
Well, I was going to ask you about, believe me, I know this case. I tried a case just like this against the hotel and lost without any issue of Cafe Moda. Thank you, Justice Barrett. Because negligence of security is a tough case, Mr. Wallace, in the courtroom and this counsel. This is not an easy case to win for a plaintiff. But if we gave you the choice of whether or not to bring the intentional tortfeasor back, you said that was acceptable under
the
question?
Right, I think that's a fair result. It gives us the remedy that we seek. Obviously, I would like to stand before you in a good conscience tell you that the plaintiff is required to bring the intentional tortfeasor in, and I think that's the problem that Justice Paragraph is having a problem with, because he doesn't need Cafe Moda to go that far.
Well, contrary to a line of case law that we've got out there already, that you can't force a plaintiff to bring people
in. And if that's the case, then the remedy, how do we get to the comparative contribution statute so that it works for a portion? And then the answer has to be, as Justice Hardesty is suggesting, is one, you must affirmatively plead the defense, and number two, you must bring and implead in the third party.
And what I'm saying to you, you don't need it to win the negligence case, not to screw up a Cafe Moda.
Well, I know where the guy is. I think I want him there. I want him there at least if he's in jail by video deposition, and if he's not in jail as Mr. Farrell is, I want him sitting at that table.
If I can make him involuntary. A battery from somebody in New York. The batterer is from New York. You're not going to bring that guy in.
Well, I could depose him. I could name him. If he doesn't want it, he can be defaulted. And then I could put him in videotape and by deposition and then testify at the trial. And we get to see it. You know, this is the thing every time you interview these plaintiffs is who caused your post-traumatic stress. It is, in fact, the attacker. That's the part that everybody seems to forget. We jump right over the idea that, yes, there's been damage suffered, but was it preventable? Could it have been done? And is it really the hotel that did it? That's what's so lovely about apportionment and several liability. For the first time, we get a fairness. Yes, the hotel might not have reacted quick enough. Maybe they were negligent, but should they bear the entire burden of the judgment? And that is what's very good about Cafe Moda, and that's what's very good about the comparative contribution statute. It gives to the parties a fair opportunity to allow a jury to evaluate all of the negligence and the different aspects of liability and to evaluate damages and apportion that liability. And that's what we're seeking. Is a remedy that gives us that.
Well, I'd like to test this theory. I have mentioned the approach taken by some courts in their evaluation of the Uniform Comparative Fault Act and focused the attention on adding the, in your case, the intentional tortfeasor to the case. Should the person who is adding the intentional tortfeasor be subjected to the same defenses as statute of limitations, for example? So if the statute has run,
except it wouldn't have earned the contribution in full, would it?
Excuse me?
It wouldn't have earned the contribution at all yet. He's still there. Yes, it would have to be, Your Honor, if there was the affirmative defense. And it would certainly work into the apportionment argument.
I guess my concern in raising this issue is that I'm uncomfortable, just speaking for myself, with these Rule 14 and 19 analysis for adding intentional tortfeasors. This seems to be an area that isn't supported by jurisprudence in other jurisdictions anywhere that I can find.
Well, then how do I get an effective remedy is the question that I have for the court. How do I get an effective evaluation of my several liability?
Perhaps it's one that has to be afforded by the legislature. Okay, thank you, Mr. Kravitz.
May it please the court, counsel. In listening to some of these questions, I think a good point comes up, and that is that New York is asking this court to do a lot of things, asking this court to give it a lot of tools, asking the court to do all sorts of things and say, well, we would like this option or that option. But what they haven't done is given you the tools to do it. They have cited not one case from anywhere that says they can get a plaintiff to be forced by court to amend their complaint, to add a new cause of action for an intentional tort, which there's not one in this case. It's simply negligent security. And they're saying that they would like the court to then order that this new plaintiff with this, excuse me, that this plaintiff with this new cause of action go out and bring an intentional tortfeasor in. They've not cited you anything to do it. What they have cited you is Cafe Moda, which is a case about when the defendants are already there. In that case, as your honors know, the plaintiff sued the intentional tortfeasor and the negligent tortfeasor. And in many situations, that is a feasible answer. That may be a just way to proceed forward with prosecuting your claim as a plaintiff. In this case, we didn't do it. They weren't there. And now the defense, New York, is asking to bring them there. And they're not giving you any tools to do it. Certainly NRCP 19 is not the tool to do it. Certainly not. Because if you look at it,
use that rule for that analysis, a plaintiff who sues a negligent tortfeasor would be thrown out of court because they hadn't joined an intentional tortfeasor. That seems to be completely contrary to the purposes behind Rule 19.
That is correct, Your Honor. We believe if you were to require the intentional negligent tortfeasor to sue all intentional tortfeasors, the plaintiffs in many, many cases would not have a just remedy. Certainly not here, the statute of limitations already ran before they raised it.
But what about the comment about the Uniform Comparative Fault Act? That does suggest that the person who wants to have that intentional tortfeasor or a non-party join would be the one responsible for bringing them into the action. Does that create an opportunity for a defendant in a negligent security case to add the intentional tortfeasor?
Your Honor, to be honest with you, this was not an issue raised in the briefing, so it's not one that I'm very familiar with. But what I would say is if that act were to be adopted, whether it would be an act that would need to be adopted by the legislature or one that could be adopted through rulemaking through this court, it would have to be something that gives the defendant the tools to do it. And if that act may give them the tools, fine.
But I should clarify, to a degree that lawyers are being victimized by the fact that our own research has generated some issues here. In fairness to you folks, you didn't have a chance to comment on this. We're sort of springing it on you because we've been doing some other research on the subject.
I guess my response would be the courts that have addressed this issue, and we do cite a number of the Florida cases from a number of different courts down in Florida that have looked at this issue of whether or not an intentional tortfeasor is a necessary
party, and they have said absolutely not. They're not. And in this jurisdiction, we haven't found a case that says that they are. We have the Reed case, which the New York cites, and we cite, which says a plaintiff has the right for themselves to who to sue. And
that's exactly what's happening. I assume, counsel, that if the court's thinking about something like this, you request an opportunity to provide supplemental briefing, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I would request the opportunity to provide a supplemental briefing on that exact issue. If that's the
question, we would join in that request.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Why don't we talk about the things you did raise then?
Certainly, Your Honor. What I would say is, Your Honor, I think you pointed out that these cases are difficult as they sit today, and they are. Because on the answer from the New York, they make this statement, and it's on page 7, stating that this scenario is not limited to casinos. Indeed, every shopping mall, apartment complex, restaurant, homeowner can face liability for the intentional acts by others merely because the events happened on their premises. That's not the law in Nevada. That's not what Dowd v. Las Vegas Hilton says. That's not what the court has clarified the foreseeability standard in the Stolen Mahoney case. It's a high standard. The plaintiff has to prove that this was foreseeable. And there's many factors that go into whether or not it was foreseeable. Then the plaintiff has to prove that their damages were proximately caused by it. The defense has a lot of opportunities to raise whatever defenses they want to raise. If they want to say we would act reasonably, this wasn't foreseeable, fine. This is a case, though, where if the jury finds them negligent, I believe my time is expired. If the jury finds them negligent, they're still saying, well, yes, we're negligent, but now we also think we should be able to shift some of the blame to somebody else. No, they're already negligent. The plaintiff has pled a simply negligent case. If we had pled something else, fine. And we believe, as we sit here today, they've simply not given this court the tools to do what they're asking you to do.
Can I ask you one additional question? This case comes to us in the context of adding a party. Would the New York DOR be entitled to a special interrogatory or a jury instruction in a case in which comparative negligence has been asserted as an affirmative defense for the jury to articulate the percentage of your negligence, of their negligence?
The answer is no, and the answer is because NRS 41-131 talks about defendants. And it uses the term defendants. It doesn't say as some individual or some entity. It talks about defendants, meaning those defendants would have to be in the cause of action. And I don't believe my reading of Cafe Moda sees anything that talks about other players other than defendants. So then the question becomes, have they correctly brought the defendants in? And in this situation, they haven't. But if they were there, certainly there would be the Cafe Moda implication. But because the case is...
I think there was actually some language in there that... anticipated that had there been any comparative negligence on behalf of plaintiff, that perhaps would have been evaluated. In that case, there wasn't any found.
I understand. I guess the way I read it is if it's a defendant, so they have to be in the case. I don't think we should be having instructions about what some other party's percentage is who's not part of the case, not able to bring their own defenses, and not able to... frankly, let the plaintiff, if they have to, cross-examine whatever issues they are. That would simply leave the defense to make some argument that somebody not there or all the evidence about that party who's not there, it's not before the jury, I guess they would have to speculate for whatever reason, this entity is now some percentage liable. We don't believe that should happen because there should need to be a party in the case, a party properly brought before the trier fact of the jury.
Okay, any other questions for counsel? All right, I'd like to thank all counsel for their arguments and assistance in the court in this legal matter. Your briefs are outstanding, and we'll be conferring on this further. Before I declare submission of this case, the panel wishes to confer further about some other legal issues that we have identified and we may ask you to comment on. Thank you.
All right.